in the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking that we could pull, I don't know, Hall of Famer. But with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now, introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com. The only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now when I buy Slab Packs on Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. There is nothing more fun than opening an Arena Club Slab Pack. I mean, it is so much better than any mystery pack that I've ever purchased because there is a focus on transparency. There is a display of available cards. There are hit rates you can get. When you're graded, you're given a rationale. It is the marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, and displaying. Arena Club Slab Packs are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling. You can have them officially graded by Arena Club. The Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with a full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. Whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform you have to check out. Right now, you can get 10% off your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/badmoney. Wow, that's a crazy offer. 10% off a $400 slab pack, that's $40 right there. Anyways, that's arenaclub.com/badmoney for 10% off your first purchase. You got problems that you ought to be concerned with. Moolah! You don't know how you're supposed to earn it, or what to do with it, or how to keep it. You're a freak with a dark, shameful secret. But you're not the only one. Get your hidden financial fears with a blast of sun. Now your healing has begun. It's Bad with Money with Gabe S. Dunn. Hello, and welcome to Bad with Money Mailbag episode special edition. Ooh, I'm your host, Gabe S. Dunn. We are going to read one of your messages, and then we have a little interview for you guys, a little additional little interview. So first, let me read this message from Cappy. Public firing, because let's get right into it. Hi, Gabe. Just writing in response to your latest mailbag episode where you asked if folks would ever go public with being fired. I've come really close. My last employer laid me off, and I still sometimes get worked up about it. But they made me sign a non-disparagement agreement in order to get severance pay. So I'm reluctant to name the company, even though a couple weeks after I signed the agreement, the NLRB ruled they're not allowed. The National Labor Relations Board. Ooh. Anyway, this company specializes in hiring autistic people for technology work, data programming, QA. Since autistic people are disproportionately un- or underemployed, they tout this mission of employing autistic people as a public service. Okay, don't love that, but let's ignore the benevolent ableism there. Throughout 2022, leadership highlighted how well the monthly financials were doing and assured folks that things were looking fine. Then in early 2023, they fired over 15% of the staff. You gotta love that, babe. Cappy, you gotta love that. I joined a video call that I thought was a regular one-on-one with my supervisor, but I was greeted by people from HR there to inform me that I was being let go. They offered only 2 weeks of severance pay, and as soon as I got off the call, they disabled my computer. I didn't even get a chance to say goodbye to the friends I'd made, and it took days for me to figure out how many others were impacted. I was an emotional wreck. That is so awful. Also, for just HR to just pop up on screen, Jesus Christ. I understand the economy is unpredictable and sometimes companies have to make hard choices, but a company that specializes in supporting autistic people should have handled this with more communication and or compassion than Twitter. It left me feeling like they just used autistic people as a convenient marketing strategy, like greenwashing, but with neurodivergence. Yep, called it from the jump. I definitely learned to be wary of for-profit companies that specialize in hiring vulnerable populations. At the end of the day, they're still capitalist ventures. Thanks, Cappy. I'm sorry you had to learn it that way, Cappy. I really do. But yeah, that's a fucking bummer. This was in a conversation about people posting themselves getting fired to TikTok, which I'm on the fence about. So write in with more convincing evidence for or against. I'm listening and I will take it under advisement. This coming from someone who made Why I Left BuzzFeed videos. Look, am I a role model and am I a hypocrite? Both. Absolute both. So now we're going to do something a little bit different than we usually do on our mailbag episodes, which is we did a much shorter interview with John Goebbels, who is from MedJet. And we wanted to talk about what can happen when you travel abroad and travel insurance and some wild stories about people who got injured or got sick away from their quote unquote home hospital. So the hospital near where they live. And what happens when that happens? How do you get back home? How much does it cost? What do you pay? And John works for a company called MedJet. So he is chilling a bit for MedJet. But I thought it would be interesting to talk to him, even just for a little while after he pitched coming on the show, because I thought it was an interesting topic we don't hear about enough. I wanted to get into travel insurance. This is a guest who presumably is a straight white cis man. I didn't ask, but all signs point to that is so. If that's wrong, write in. I don't typically love to interview people that are not of a marginalized community on the main episodes. We have only interviewed one cis straight white man in the show's history, and it was in an episode about the penny. And fun fact, Benjamin Applebaum, the guy that we interviewed in that segment, later went on to become the guy from the Pete Buttigieg meme who says, "You fixed bread prices." And if you don't know that meme, it's very funny. Buttigieg gets really upset at the New York Times talking about how he worked for a company that fixed bread prices. But the guy from that meme is the same guy that was on our show talking about the penny. And one of my questions for him was, why do only white men care about the penny? Because we could not find an expert to talk about it that wasn't a white guy. So this is an interview with a different white guy, a rarity on this show, extremely rare, but I thought it was an interesting topic. In general, I'd be curious to know what you guys think. I do think there is an element of like class privilege and racial privilege. And there's a lot of different things that get touched on in this episode that I will probably bring up again in a future episode, maybe a mailbag with you guys writing in what you think, because I certainly have my thoughts. Once we all hear the episode in full or the interview in full, we'll discuss it in another episode. Yeah. Okay. Let me know what you guys think. And with me today, John, do you want to tell my audience who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Gabe. My name is John Goebbels, and I am the Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of MedJet. We are a travel membership program, and I appreciate you having me on.
So what is travel insurance?
Well, travel insurance is a stark contrast from what we are. So we are a travel membership company, which is different, but travel insurance itself gets very confused with the travel membership program. Travel insurance is like the cancellation, trip cancellation, or lost baggage. It does have medical benefits, and it will have some limited transport benefits in an emergency situation to get you to kind of the closest medical facility. And in contrast, travel membership program like MedJet, we're a product that actually gets you from that hospital all the way back to your home hospital. So, you know, if you're hospitalized in France and you've had a heart attack and you want to get back to your home hospital in New York, a lot of times a travel insurance product will not do that because you may be stable there and it may not be medically necessary. Travel membership program like MedJet, we take you from that hospital back to your hospital of choice in your home country. And we place that decision-making process in your hands, not the insurance companies.
So yeah, can you explain? It's basically like if you are hospitalized in another country, you're able to help, or like, because I don't even know how that would work actually, if you were traveling and you got like super sick somewhere.
Yeah. So the MedJet program is not just international. So if you're hospitalized more than 150 miles from home, that's where your MedJet membership could possibly benefit you. So if you're hospitalized more than 150 miles, could be for something as simple as a broken arm or broken leg or something much more serious, and you require continued hospitalization at your home hospital, MedJet will make and pay for those arrangements to transport you from that hospital where you're at all the way back to your hospital at home.
Whoa. And you mentioned travel insurance. I did not realize, I thought travel insurance was like, oh, if your plane gets delayed or canceled or something, but there's parts of it where it takes into account like an emergency or like a medical emergency.
Sure, it can. And so, yeah, so like trip delay, trip cancellation, those are all the kind of the buzzwords of that. But it's really important that kind of your listeners understand that there are some travel insurance products that do provide some limited medical transport benefits, as well as kind of paying for the medical bills, which is usually the reason people get them if they're taking like a big international trip to Africa or something like that. They need someone to be able to pay for those medical treatments while you're hospitalized. But really, not many of them will actually move you back to your home hospital like the a medical transport membership like MedJet would. And that's the vastly expensive part of that. So, you know, if you're on safari in Africa and they need to just move you to the closest hospital, that's relatively inexpensive. But to get from Africa back to New York, that could be close to $200,000. So not a lot of people have that disposable income to do that. And that's where a MedJet membership would take care of all those costs.
So what about the part that talks about like crisis response? Like if it's not like a medical, because I'm just thinking about, I remember when COVID started, people were like, oh my God, how do I get to here? How do I get to there? Like what is an example or what kind of could happen with like a crisis response situation if you're somewhere far away?
Sure. So we have partnered with a company called Focus Point International, and they provide our crisis response services as part of our MedJet Horizon package. And that's kind of an add-on to our medical transport benefits. And if you're somewhere and, you know, you feel that you're in jeopardy, if there is a civil unrest or a terrorist incident or things like that, they have basically the expertise to be able to intervene on your behalf and move you to the closest safe haven or maybe a hotel across town if you've got some local disturbances going on. So a lot of different nuances with that, but that is the part of the MedJet Horizon program that we offer that really has been extremely popular over the last several years.
Do you have experience with this kind of thing?
Personally, I have not had to use that, but this is something that is, I don't want to say it's used daily, but more often than you think. The nice thing about not having a hard trigger, and a hard trigger on some other products is where your government says, like the United States would say, you know, there's civil unrest in Kenya and you should no longer travel there. The MedJet Horizon product, actually, if you feel unsafe, so if you've got some demonstrations on the street in front of you and you just feel unsafe in your hotel, you can call the Crisis Response Center and they will intervene on your behalf for that. And it doesn't really have to involve a hard trigger such as the U.S. government. And that could take like days to a week to actually be done. So you would be stuck kind of where you're at until that would be considered a hard trigger.
And the governments of these places are allow you guys to do that?
They do. Really what's utilized is in-country assets is really what it's called. So they're using people in the country that you're currently in. So, you know, a lot of times they're not sending people from the United States into, say, Kenya, perhaps. They would use a security team that's already established with that country's nationals to be able to effectuate your movement within that country.
Oh, that's so interesting. It says in your bio that you were working for Stat Medevac. And so can you talk about like what that was and what that like what you did there?
I started at Stat Medevac actually as a flight nurse and paramedic. So Stat Medevac was a very large hospital-based air medical transport program. We did both rotorcraft, so helicopters and fixed-wing transport. So I started there as a critical care flight nurse and paramedic and worked up through there. I spent roughly about 15 years there, 14 or 15 years, and left as kind of administrative director there. But yeah, it's my entire really career in healthcare and public safety, fire, police, and emergency medical services.
What do you mean? What is a flight nurse?
Well, I think of it, Gabe, as like a nurse that is on an airplane. So, you know, if you're like, you know, hospitalized somewhere, let's say like we're talking about in Kenya, we would fly over to you and I would be there at the hospital and pick you up and get you into the aircraft and take care of you all the way back to your home hospital. So that's what flight nursing is. It's basically nursing or, you know, taking care of people in the air.
Well, do you have any, you must have a million insane stories, but like, do you have one that stands out?
Well, I mean, I've been here for, you know, I think almost 18 years now, and it never ceases to amaze me the things that we have. And, you know, we have mundane things, but, you know, just recently we've had, you know, two people in New Zealand. One had passed away on a world cruise. The other one had had a bad gastrointestinal illness that we had brought back. We've got somebody in Cambodia right now. But as, you know, crazy stories, we've had people attacked by, you know, buffalo in South Africa. We've had domestically a great guy, great story, a guy riding a motorcycle, and I'm an adventure motorcycle rider as well. And we had a guy that like hit a cow, you know, traveling on a motorcycle, and he was hurt very, very badly.
I bet.
Yeah, an air ambulance transport back from where he was. So it's just stories like that. And then we do the routine things like, you know, heart attacks and strokes, but it's all very, very, you know, it's bad for the people that are experiencing them, but we really try to make that as easy of a process as we can for somebody that is going through that stressful of a situation.
Oh my God. So if somebody doesn't have like travel insurance or anything like this, you said it could run like $200,000 to bring someone back from like overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even domestically, an air ambulance transport domestically from the West Coast to the East Coast could easily be $30,000 or $35,000. And, you know, Africa, Europe, you're into the 150s, Asia, you're over the 200s. And we unfortunately have people daily that will call us and looking to arrange that because they don't have travel insurance, or they don't have a travel membership program, and they have to pay out of pocket for that. And we've got story after story of like multiple family members, everybody like maxing out credit cards, like five different credit cards, trying to pay to get, you know, grandma back from Jesus. Africa, where she was on, you know, a generational trip with family. So it can be devastating financially for people that really don't think about that, because a lot of times you don't worry about that. You know, you want to go on vacation and have a great time, and you think you're healthy. You know, you and I probably don't think anything can happen to us. You know, you're young and I'm not so young anymore, but you know, things do happen when we least expect them, and they can be financially devastating.
What was it like during COVID working for this?
So, you know, good and bad. MedJet was one of the first organizations that we actually added COVID transport to our membership program. So we work very closely with the air ambulance companies. Early on, before we knew a lot about COVID, the air ambulance companies actually had purchased pod systems for the patients inside the aircraft and did a lot of crew training, but really travel just stopped. We still did transports during COVID, but it just wasn't as much. We had some people trapped in other countries because countries basically locked them in and wouldn't let them leave other countries. So the MedJet Horizon program was really instrumental in allowing those people and getting those people out of those countries. But, you know, COVID was, you know, a good and a bad thing in some ways for, you know, for us, because, you know, obviously travel had stopped, so we didn't have so many transports going on. But those transports that did need to be done were like 10 fold difficult as a normal transport would be.
Yeah. What, there were pods on the plane? What do you mean?
Yeah. So basically some companies developed these pods where basically, you know, if you think of like an incubator for a child, you know, a critically ill child, it would be for an adult. So it would be, you know, as long as the stretcher, and basically the patient would be inside of that pod. There would be oxygen in there, and you could, you know, put gloved hands through and take care of the patient and do the things you needed to do. And that was, again, as I said, kind of early on. But then, you know, a year later, we realized, you know, there were hoods that patients could wear, and then just masks. And then, you know, after the, you know, vaccines and things like that, it has gotten easier and easier and more back to normal.
Oh my.
As much as it could be. But initially, they would actually place people in pods inside the aircraft.
People that had COVID or just anybody?
Yes. No, people that just had COVID. So normal people were fine. But if you had COVID, you know, we didn't know, you know, what was this going to do? And you didn't want to infect the flight crew or the pilots or the traveling companions. So they literally would put them, you know, in pods.
Oh, my God. That is so
sounds
wild.
Horrible. Yeah.
It sounds horrible. Yeah. I mean, so the other countries, because it's like hard to get any two countries on the same page about anything. So it seems wild to me that like, you know, some European Slovakia or whatever would be like, yeah, fly in your MedJet. Like, we'll get you out. We'll get you to the US. Like, it feels like so hard to do or to like work with all of these places to be like, because I imagine there are some places that are like, no.
You're exactly correct. It's almost like you've done this before. But yeah, there are some places that You know, it took weeks of planning and permitting to be able to do that. And some countries were like, absolutely not. They have to stay here. They would quarantine in these quarantine locations and then move out of quarantine and get tested and tested and tested and then finally be able to be released. But we worked as many diplomatic areas as we could to be able to move patients back to the United States.
What about during like non-COVID times or post-vaccine? Like these other countries are fine with like working with this?
Yeah, at this point, we really have not run into really any issues at all. Specifically, probably within the last 12 months. Prior to that, you'd still have some issues here and there. But at this point, I don't want to say it's business as usual, but we really don't run into any problems anymore.
What does it cost to have this sort of program? Like for that per person?
We've got both like short-term and annual memberships. So you can get a short-term membership, an eight-day short-term for $99. And it's the same level that an annual membership for an individual, which is like $295, and it provides you the same level of service. There's no lower level of service. If you get an annual versus an eight-day short-term, it still provides you the same level. It's just on a short-term basis. But our annual memberships, you know, $295 for an individual, $399 for a family. So that's like, you know, individual plus, you know, spouse, partner, up to five dependent children for that price. And again, when you look at a bill of, you know, over $200,000 to potentially bring you back, that is money well spent.
What are the jets? Like, they're just like private jets. What are they?
Yeah. So we move our members basically two different ways. First is the most, you know, what everybody thinks when they think of MedJet is a dedicated air ambulance. And we use authorized affiliate groups that are dedicated air ambulance companies that maintain, most of them are Learjet series, which is, you know, basically it's a medical intensive care unit. Two pilots, two crew members, usually a nurse and paramedic or a nurse and a respiratory therapist. And that is basically on a stretcher the whole way back. And then if you're not quite as ill, you know, let's say you're traveling somewhere and you may break an arm or a shoulder and you just need some assistance getting back. If you still require that inpatient hospitalization, we send what's called a nurse escort. And that's a nurse that would go to you commercially, bring you back in a business or first class seat, take care of all the arrangements, get you through security quickly, everything that you would need. So depending on your clinical condition is how we would basically determine what mode of transport would be right for you.
That's so wild. That's like, you just don't ever think about that kind of thing. Like I wouldn't even, like you said, someone died on a cruise ship. Like I was like, I would be like, okay. And then the person dies on the cruise ship. And then you're like, what is even the next, like 911? Like, what do you even, like you tell the people on the cruise, like, this person is dead. And then it's sort of like, okay, I guess we have to like dock the ship and go through all this stuff about like, there must be like a million paperworks, a million, like, I guess they have your number if they're a member, but yeah. It just seems like so crazy.
Yeah. And especially internationally, but you know, you're right. So they would let the ship know like, hey, you know, the medical team would come from the ship and they would do what they need to do. And if things didn't go well, just in this instance where someone may pass away, which happens more often than you think, you know, they would at the next port.
On cruise ships
and everywhere. I mean, but on cruise ships there, yeah, it happens. It happens, but they'll port and take the body to the local mortuary. You know, the family will call us. We will start having those communications between that, getting all the paperwork done. It's a huge process, Gabe, to get that taken care of. But that's what we do. That's what we're here for, is to navigate that for the family.
Jeez, that's so wild. But you guys are not doing any like diplomatic stuff. Like you're not like, I mean, I guess you do have to talk to those people, but like you're not like, I don't know. That's just so wild sometimes to think about what is possible, and it's done in a private sector, but not done by the government of the place. Like even just in the US, like that the US government decides yes or no if they're going to send people to like get someone. And oftentimes they're like, no. But then there's like this gap in the private sector.
Yeah, the government usually, I mean, that's not what they do. I mean, other than the U.S. military, you know, bringing right. back service members, it's really left to the private sector to be able to handle that. So. That's
yeah, that's so wild. So I'm just thinking about all the scenarios that could happen and they're all very stressful. So what, like if someone's trying to figure out, Like, are there certain places that it's easier for you to work with than other places?
You know, domestically, obviously, is simple. You know, Europe is very simple from that standpoint. You get into, you know, some of the countries like China, for instance, you know, we're able to travel back to China now. But the permitting process in China for them to allow, you know, you and I could travel there, no problem. But when we try to get an air ambulance to schedule to go in there and remove somebody is very difficult. It could take, you know, several days to a week or more just for the Chinese government to allow us permission to come into China to be able to remove that patient. You know, you look at Russia right now, there's no way to do that. You know, we're at war basically for that. So we can't do overflights over Russia anymore. So that's very difficult. We have to take, you know, before we would go up through kind of Alaska and then across and then into China that way. Now we have to do the southern route. So off the West Coast through Australia and then back up. So that has, you know, majorly increased the pricing for these trips that were already expensive to begin with. But so I think the further you go kind of east, the more difficult it gets to do this is really the reality of it.
Wow. Do you have a story that doesn't involve the person dying?
Of course. Like that's like a very small percentage of that.
I know. I'm just joking.
Yeah. We just had a, you know, the most recent one was a nice woman in New Zealand that was there visiting and had a really bad attack of some gastrointestinal illness and was hospitalized for a while. She called us. We worked with her hospitals at home to get her admitted there and then sent a nurse escort on that one to actually bring her back because she was up and walking around and really just needed some help. You know, she was in her 70s and didn't want to do it alone. She didn't have anybody traveling with her. So she was traveling alone. So this was something, and she cried, you know, when we said, like, we're coming to get you and we're going to send somebody to bring you back. She was tearful on the phone because she didn't believe she could do it. So that was just very rewarding. And, you know, we've had some domestic trips just locally for some cardiac issues, frequent care, ambulance transport. And then people write some great letters that, you know, they kept like looking in the mailbox for the bill. You know, they didn't believe what they had. Like, you know, how could something that, you know, only costs $99 for an 8-day short term, you know, they flew me all the way across the country. It had to be $30,000 or $40,000. They wait for the bill to come and it doesn't. So a lot of great people and a lot of great stories that we have. But, and I don't mean to make it like mundane, but it's what I deal with every day. So, mm-hmm. You know, to somebody that doesn't know, they'd be like, oh my gosh, that story is fantastic. And to us, it's just really, it's what we do. It's our job. We grind it and we just do it every day and make sure we do the best that we can for our members.
How did this start? Was there like, there was just a gap?
It actually was a Swiss model way back when. The Swiss were the first to do this, to repatriate people from their own country back that would travel abroad and bring them back into their own healthcare system. And this company, which, you know, current ownership since about 1998, kind of saw that need here and started, you know, were the first to start the membership model, but really one of the first here in the United States to do that. And it's been wonderful.
Who took it from the Swiss model? Like just some founders out here?
Yeah, basically here in the United States, there were several countries that were doing it, but it kind of spread kind of into Europe and then here to the United States. It's just, there was just no way to get people back. People were either having to remain hospitalized for weeks or months until they could travel on their own. You know, insurance companies started looking at how, you know, they could help people that were, you know, hospitalized locally, domestically. And I think that just probably grew that model to be able to expand that for companies like MedJet to be able to do that on a domestic and international basis.
That's fascinating. Like my grandparents went on safari, I think when I was in maybe middle school. And I remember being like, what are you doing here? What are you okay? But like, that is the age where they had the money to do that stuff or the time to do that stuff. And you're like, okay, I wish it didn't work that way. I wish you could go when you were younger. So we're not just like hoping for the best.
Right.
They were in France during 9/11 and they had to come back over and they're one of those planes that got into Nova Scotia. And then they were like in Nova Scotia for like 2 weeks or whatever it was until they could like get back into the US. And that was a total clusterfuck. Absolutely. And like, There was what do you do? Nothing. There's nothing you could do.
They turned everybody around. We had work partners that were, it's funny, we were in France visiting American Eurocopter when I worked for Stat Medevac. They were there for weeks because they couldn't get out.
Yeah, there was nothing that you, there was no like way. It was funny because even people that like had money, they were like, yeah, still no, sorry. It was very interesting too, because there weren't really like cell phones as much. So it was like, we were just like, for like a week, we were like, where the fuck are they?
Yeah, like, just panic where? Situation. Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on. And where can people find out more about you guys and about what you do?
Easy enough. It's medjet.com. We've got a wonderful group of membership services representatives. You always talk to a live person no matter what. And they can walk you through all the programs, explain everything, and find a membership that's right for you. And thank you again, Gabe, for having me on.
Of course. Managing my finances is incredibly stressful and time-consuming. I'm sure you guys know. You've been with me on this journey. You know how many finance apps I've tried. You know how much they haven't worked for me. And I'm always on the hunt for a finance app that fits my life. And then I tried Monarch. It is so easy to use with powerful features, collaboration tools, intuitive design, personalization, constant product improvements. I really value an app that allows me to do all of this without confusion. And especially important to me is intuitive design and the ability to personalize, because clearly finance is not one size fits all. Did you know that money issues are a leading cause of divorce? Monarch, the top-rated personal finance app, also has built-in collaboration features so you can invite your partner at no extra cost. Together, you can see all your finances, collaborate on your budget, and get insights on your cash flow and recurring transactions. It's the easiest way to manage your household finances. Are you saving for a down payment, a wedding, a dream vacation? Monarch makes it so easy to help you reach your financial goals. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Have you been frustrated with personal finance apps that are cluttered with ads, difficult to use, rarely updated? So was Monarch. They built a new kind of personal finance app that's intuitive and powerful and ad-free and constantly improving based on customer feedback. Experience a personal finance app that prioritizes the user experience above all else. Monarch is the top-rated, all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/badmoney. Unlike other personal finance apps, Monarch's simple, intuitive design makes it so easy to set up, customize, and use. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Plus, there's ad-free privacy you can trust. We will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/badmoney. That's monarchmoney.com/badmoney for your extended 30-day free trial. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a new candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy. It would be so much easier if I was looking for someone to help me with sweetening audio, or let's say someone to run my merch shop, or all the little things that go into running a podcast. Usually something like that would be so slow and overwhelming. And honestly, I wish I had used Indeed, and I will use Indeed in the future. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/badwithmoney. Just go to Indeed.com/badwithmoney right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/badwithmoney. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math and see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything is more expensive these days when you're running a business, and you would be wise to find proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. The fact that you are able to reduce your IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud is incredible. And the ability to access your cloud financial system from anywhere saves you so much time and stress. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/badwithmoney. 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 We're going to start this off because we're high energy with a voicemail from a listener. That's right. You can leave a voice memo at gabeisbadwithmoney@gmail.com. And this one has a cute little accent.
Recently, we just had a law pass. I think all of Australia, not just Victoria where I live, I think. It's like a workers' rights law, and it's called the right to disconnect. So it's like the right to not be contacted or have to respond to contact from an employer or like a third party related to work outside of your traditional working hours or your stipulated like working hours. It passed recently. I think it's in place in the law. Sorry, I'm a bit vague on the details, but yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know if other places in the world have that, if it's a new thing. I'm not really sure exactly. I mean, obviously there was lobbying around getting that in place. I'm not sure if what specific situations, you know, like led most to it being put in place. I did hear like some concerns about how it would work, like in terms of like, you know, if your employer wants to contact you because there's, you know, an available shift that wasn't available before and, you know, you might want it or like that kind of thing. I think there's sort of room for that stuff, but I did hear a little bit of sort of naysaying about it or people criticizing it for thinking it was like over the top, but that's probably just conservative people or something. I don't know. Anyway, I don't know too much more about it, but you might want to look into it a bit more. I'm also listening to this episode a couple of days before I go on some much needed leave from my job, a couple of weeks just to have a break. I work in the mental health sector in like for the government, and it's really intense. And two of my colleagues resigned today, who one of whom has been there for about a year longer than me and who I really love and admire. And yeah, basically they're going to work in the private sector because they can get paid more and work less hours and have better quality of life. And also, I guess the people that they will be helping won't be as in need or in as dire sort of acute, you know, mental health crises as the ones that we see. Gonna have my break before I have a total career crisis. But yeah, it's a job. The job we do is very innately has burnout associated with it, and is a job that I guess innately everyone accepts you can't do forever. It's just not possible. We have a reasonably good culture and good colleagues. We're very supportive of each other. Like the management is good. You know, there's a lot of good things going for us. And yet, by nature of the demand on the system and how the job works, you just can't do it forever. Like it's just not possible. None of us can. And some of us don't know, you know, some people last longer than others. And there's almost a bit of pride in kind of sticking it out. But also, I know I have colleagues that have definitely stayed there too long and are too burnt out and stuck. Anyway, I've just been reflecting on, the difficulty of being in a specific career or job specifically within that career that is just not possible to do ongoingly. Like you have to leave it at some point. It's like a weird position to be in. I don't know if that related to the episode much, but just some thoughts. Okay, bye.
Thank you so much for calling in. That's absolutely relevant. It's absolutely on topic with what we were talking about. We've done some really great episodes here on Bad with Money where we talked about work ethic and the ways in which work is viewed in different countries. So we did one that was about Germany and about South Korea and about the Netherlands. And, you know, in South Korea, it was basically this idea of working really hard and always making sure that your boss sees you working hard, making sure that your boss never sees you leave the office before them, making sure that you're going out enough with your colleagues to show your face versus like places like the Netherlands that were like, hey, we want to give you a lot of time off so that you can spend time with your family or have PTO or stuff like that. And that was really interesting to look at the ways in which these different cultures view work. So, you know, something like what you're talking about in New Zealand, I would hope is something that could catch on in other places. I mean, that's why it's so important that we have unions for our jobs. That's why it's so important that we have places that are willing to represent us and protect us. But I will say the person who wrote in a while back about how they actually did start implementing boundaries at work and they actually did start not working as hard or working late, or I don't even want to say not working as hard, just not doing more than their job was paying them to do. They did say that they suffered consequences, but in terms of like their boss's happiness with their overall performance and things like that, but they did spend more time with family and it did make them realize that they wanted a different type of job. So I don't want to live in sort of an idealistic utopia situation where this could be accomplished without legal protections. And that even if we do get similar laws here in the States as to what they're doing in New Zealand, as if people wouldn't exploit that anyway. But I don't want to also lose my entire utopian ideals around work not becoming chained to your desk from 8 to 7, even though you're only paid from 9 to 5. I'd be curious if you're from another country and your country has something similar to what this listener called in about. I would love to hear about it. I would love to hear about any upcoming laws that people are trying to pass in other countries that are similar to this. I would love to, any country you're from that isn't the US, I would love to know how your country views work and how it views work hours and time off, PTO, maternity leave, anything, paternity leave, anything like that with regards to how hard you're supposed to be working. And I know that's different in different sectors, but just in general, if you have like a cursory overview of what your country's view of work is, I would love to hear it because I know we have the American dream here. And so I'm curious what that's like for people in other countries. Now I'm going to read a message from Marty. Hey, Gabe, I'm writing about the buy nothing trend you talked about in the last mailbag episode. I can honestly say I haven't heard about it before, but I was unknowingly doing it for a while. It started when I decided to move countries and the suitcase with all my clothes, and I mean all, from underwear to nice office clothes and shoes, got lost in transit. I never got the suitcase back. It was probably stolen from what they found out. So I had to buy a whole new wardrobe while getting acclimated to the new country. It was hard at first. There were some very nice things that had sentimental value and were high quality, but it really helped me realize two things. One, I know what I like, and as long as I have things that are nice enough to last, I prefer taking care of them, as opposed to always trying to get something new that will rot in my closet after getting worn a few times. Okay, Marty, read me to filth. Also, this situation with your suitcase is an absolute nightmare. I'm so sorry that happened to you. That is my full nightmare. I don't mean to say, wow, this terrible thing that happened to you sucks and I'm glad it didn't happen to me, but the idea is so stressful to me and I'm so sorry that that happened, especially with sentimental clothing. I would just feel really unnerved. I'm so sorry. Okay, two, Marty says, I never want to have so many things that I will have to deal with the emotional turmoil of dealing with their loss. Yeah, I can imagine. Accidents happen. Afterwards, I had a few boxes with bedding and some house stuff get moldy after the basement they were kept in got flooded. I have the worst luck with these things, apparently. Fires, floods, financial troubles, and so on. And I don't want to go through having to realize how much money I had lost when dealing with the insurance. Since then, I only buy something if it catches my eye and stays in my mind for a few days or if it's impossible for me to repair, which sadly, in a lot of cases, is jeans. This was mostly a story I thought would be interesting from the perspective of an accidental practitioner. If I had to give advice on how to think about these things, though, is think about spending the money you would have spent on clothes and items on something else you enjoy instead. If you like fashion, think about picking up sewing, knitting, weaving, or the numerous hobbies connected with it. It will bring you more lasting joy and you will feel more connected to your clothes. If you like the thrill of spending money, think about doing that on experiences, classes, or even food. I, for example, like to treat myself with fancy cheese every once in a while if I feel the urge to get something new. Just think on what is really exciting about buying new things and see if there is a hobby or an experience that can replace the mindless consumption of products instead. It can be about saving money, but can also be about redirecting them to something that will bring you more lasting joy. It makes you appreciate the things you have more, and it opens you up to new things, which is great. Anyway, hope there was something useful in this whole rant. Best wishes, Marty. This was not a rant, Marty. This was extremely helpful. This is extremely useful. And I think it's a great way to rethink spending money. I think sometimes people do buy nothing as like a big sacrifice, a big scrimp. And one of the things that we always talk about on this show is that it's not about not spending. It's about like redirecting or rethinking what you are spending or rethinking what your priorities are, or even making lists of what is important to you. So I actually think this was really beautifully written and really beautifully said and evoked. I think you covered a lot of what I would want to say, but you said it in a very nice and poetic way. And like the last paragraph especially was really lovely. And yeah, I think that this is something that hopefully people have taken away from this show. And I hope that this puts a little bow on it for people, because I'm especially someone who used to use buying things to feel better about myself. And I used to use them to fill a void. I used to use it to fill a void in my heart that, you know, we talk about actually in an upcoming episode with Marilyn Reisgab about how when you don't grow up with a lot of money and you finally do have money from something, you feel like you want to spend it in order to feel safety and security and to prove to yourself that you're never going to be broke again. Hey guys, Gabe Dunn here. I just wanted to let you guys know that I have a Patreon at patreon.com/GabeSDunn. And on that Patreon, I'm going to start doing live hangs with everyone who is a patron. So if you want to join the Patreon, you can get all these episodes ad-free, videos of our mailbag episodes, extra writing from me, blogs, fiction, other stuff, things that I'm thinking about with regards to money and personal stories. And also now live hangs with me on Zoom once a month. So join the Patreon. And if you're not a member of the Discord, hop on over to the Discord. That's free. The link will be in the description. It's so fun. So many of you guys talk over there. It's like truly popping off. And if you're on the Discord, I would love to see you in the live hang so I get to put a face to a name. So yeah, please join patreon.com/GabeSDunn and come hang out with me. I love to track progress. As you guys know from listening to this show, I'm constantly tracking my progress. What have we done so far in 2024? And spring is in full bloom. Are your finances blooming too? With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa credit card, it's easy to start building credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments with no annual fees or interest. And if your credit scores grow, so could your opportunities for lower rates on loans like for a car or a home. You can use it everywhere Visa credit cards are accepted. That's right, you can build your credit using your own money. Get paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. With a qualifying direct deposit, you can get access to your money sooner. Fee-free overdraft with SpotMe. Overdraft up to $200 without fees with SpotMe when you set up a qualified direct deposit. Just set up a qualifying direct deposit, sign up for SpotMe, and Chime will spot you up to your limit when you make a credit card purchase or cash withdrawal that exceeds your balance. Access 60,000 plus fee-free ATMs. That's more than the top three national banks combined. Easily find one near you with the Chime app. Send and receive money. Use Chime to pay anyone, Chime members or not, and cash out your money fee-free. With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started at chime.com/badmoney. That's chime.com/badmoney. Chime. Feels like progress. The Chime Credit Builder Visa credit card is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A., members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details. This week I have an article from CNBC about how CVS and Walgreens are going to start selling the abortion pill this month. I have a lot of thoughts on the use of the word abortion pill. I know we shouldn't kowtow to conservatives, and I know that that is what it is, and that abortion is healthcare and a human right, and that bodily autonomy is also a human right, and that this is a health situation and a health issue. But I feel like sometimes the words used are like buzzwords to make a certain demographic really angry. Like, I've always thought that about the morning after pill, where I'm like, I understand how that is helpful framing for people who are like, when do I take this or what is this good for? But I also know that it like feel like it's bad marketing because it lets people be like, oh, they're just using it for birth control, which by the way, you can. That's it, all of it is healthcare. So I'm always worried about our marketing, but I know that politically it doesn't matter that much and that I should probably just get over it. But yeah, sometimes I really think about the way, well, you know what? I'm a wordsmith and I really think about the way words are used and the way certain words are propagating certain political ideals, right? Like, why do we say pro-life instead of, you know, anti-choice or pro-choice? You know, like a lot of that has been in order to create like clearer messaging when it comes to liberal and leftist ideas. So anyway, so CVS and Walgreens have received certification from the FDA to dispense the commonly used mifepristone, sorry if I got that wrong, at retail pharmacies. They cannot provide them by mail, but you'll be able to get the abortion pill, so-called, at certain pharmacy locations in states where it's legal to do so, such as New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, California, and Illinois. And this is very cool. You know, it comes on the heels of obviously Roe v. Wade being overturned. And I was thinking this week about the interview that came out in the New York Times with Biden. That was a deeply disappointing interview where they asked him, you know, if you win in 2024, what are you going to do? And one of the things he spoke about was he said he would bring back Roe v. Wade and like, you know, try to bring back like abortion rights. And then in the interview, he said, I don't necessarily believe in my body, my choice, but I understand that this is like important to Democrats or something. And I was like, the Democratic nominee in the year of our Lord 2024 is basically being like, I don't care about bodily autonomy. This just is like a political move or whatever. Like, just leave out the second part. Why the fuck did you have to say, oh, not for me. I don't believe in it, but who cares? Like, you're just alienating people already. They're already alienated from when you talk about genocide holding an ice cream cone. Like, we don't have time. I don't know. That whole interview was really a huge fucking bummer. And it also makes me think of the situation with embryos in Alabama, where I just saw this very interesting video of this mommy vlogger, my number one enemy. But anyway, this one has some thoughts. It took a lot of IVF for her to get pregnant. She finally got pregnant. And then now she has these embryos saved and she's not sure. She lives in Alabama. She's not sure if she wants to use them or what she wants to do with them. But if she gets rid of any of them, there could be criminal charges because they're viewing the embryos as babies. And even she, this sort of like very, you know, certain type of woman, was saying there's no way in which these embryos are the same as babies. There's no way in which I should be punished for not using them. Like, it's very interesting. It's sort of a, as we call it on the Just Between Us, Too Long Did Read It show, oh no consequences, which not to say that these are the consequences of her actions, but just, you know, this idea that suddenly these laws affect people who are not who they imagine it affects. So that's very interesting. Largely, I'm just really fed up with Biden and the non-committal nature of everything he says and why our Democratic nominee is an ancient man sipping on an ice cream cone, talking about how he doesn't really care about bodily autonomy. Well, well, well. Speaking of medical stuff, let's stay on medical stuff. A federal judge rejected AstraZeneca's legal challenge to Medicare's new power to negotiate the prices of certain costly prescription drugs with manufacturers. So basically, there's price gouging, right? I mean, they used to call it price gouging. Now they're just like, oh, negotiations. But it's basically the idea that the pharmaceutical industry can make things cost whatever they cost. Is it constitutional for the pharmaceutical industry to have control over these prices? What does this do? This comes under Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, which aims to make medicine more affordable for seniors, but it would take a chunk out of the pharmaceutical industry's profits, according to this article on CNBC. So it appears that this affects drugs that are used to treat type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, heart failure, and they're just negotiating the prices for the first round of drugs that are going to go into effect in 2026. Drug prices have been increasingly higher and higher, I think due to monopolies on who makes these drugs and the effectiveness of the specific types of drugs versus their generics versus more off-brand types, not just for pharmaceutical companies, but for insurance companies, it's the idea that, well, they'll make more money, they'll get more inflated, they'll pay the pharmaceutical company. But what about the people that can't afford any of that? They just won't get their meds. Like, that's just what's going to happen. They won't get their meds. And that's how we're just agreeing to live. This comes under Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, which aims to make medicine more affordable for seniors, but it would take a chunk out of the pharmaceutical industry's profits, according to this article on CNBC. So it appears that this affects drugs that are used to treat type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, heart failure, and they're just negotiating the prices for the first round of drugs that are going to go into effect in 2026. Drug prices have been increasingly higher and higher, I think, due to monopolies on who makes these drugs and the effectiveness of the specific types of drugs versus their generics versus more off-brand types, not just for pharmaceutical companies, but for insurance companies, it's the idea that, well, they'll make more money, they'll get more inflated, they'll pay the pharmaceutical company. But what about the people that can't afford any of that? They just won't get their meds. Like, that's just what's going to happen. They won't get their meds. And that's how we're just agreeing to live. Well, thank you for listening to this mailbag special interview edition. Let me know what you guys think. And you can write in at GabeIsBadWithMoney@gmail.com. Love you guys. Bye. Bad with Money with Gabe Shane Dunn is a production of Noted Bisexual, produced by Melissa D. Montz and Diamond Imprint Productions, edited by Diane King, post-production sound by Coco Lorenz, and music by Mike Kaplan, Zach Sherwin, and Jack Dolgen, as sung by Sam Barbera. Thank you. Love you. Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.